Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Today's case takes us to Donaghadee, a small coastal town in County Down, Northern Ireland, which sits quietly on the Ards Peninsula, about 18 miles east of Belfast. With its picturesque harbour, historic lighthouse and a steady rhythm of daily life, it's the kind of place people choose for its calm. A lovely retirement haven with sea air and friendly neighbours. But in October 2006, the quiet comfort of Donaghadee was shattered, and not just for one household. What happened here would leave a lasting scar across the entire community. At the centre of it all was 77-year-old Matilda Campbell, known to most as Tilly. Tilly had lived in Donaghadee nearly all her life, over 60 years in fact. She wasn't someone who made headlines or sought attention. In many ways, she was the very definition of local, rooted in the town, known by the people and part of the fabric of daily life. Born in or around 1929, she'd spent decades working hard, raising a family and building a quiet life with her husband and children. In her younger years, she worked in the local carpet factory, a place that once provided employment for many in the area. It wasn't glamorous work, but she was reliable and well-liked, remembered by colleagues as cheerful and dependable. Over time, she built a reputation as someone you could trust, someone who didn't pass you on the street without saying hello. When her husband passed away in 2004, Tilly moved into a modest home in Branagh Park, one of a row of bungalows designed for older residents. Though her health was beginning to decline, she still wanted to keep her independence. She had two adult children, a son named Don and a daughter named Julie, and was a grandmother as well. Family meant the world to her, and while she now lived alone, she was rarely lonely. Neighbours saw her often and spoke fondly of her. She was kind, always up for a chat, and well known in the town. But Tilly's life in Branagh Park wasn't just about slowing down. Even at 77, she was still making plans. Her mobility wasn't what it used to be, and she could no longer walk long distances without difficulty. Still, she refused to be completely reliant on others. In fact, she had been carefully putting money aside to buy herself a mobility scooter. A sign not just of practicality, but of pride. She wanted to remain active, to get around on her own terms. It says something about her character, that even as her body slowed down, her spirit stayed strong. In many ways, she represented the heart of Donaghadee. Neighbourly, unassuming and deeply rooted in the rhythms of the small town life. The kind of person whose presence is felt more in the everyday moments than in any grand gestures. So when the news of what happened to her spread, it shook people. This was not the kind of place where violence lived. And it certainly wasn't the kind of place where an elderly woman was expected to be at risk in her own home. What happened to her wasn't just a crime, it was a rupture in the sense of safety that towns like Donaghadee are built on. And that's where this story begins. In the early hours of Monday, the 9th of October 2006, life on Branagh Park was still and silent, as you'd expect in a quiet housing estate at that time of night. But sometime around 1:45 a.m, one resident, Derek Lismore, who lived just a few doors down at number 41, was stirred from his sleep. He heard a sharp crash, something sudden and unmistakable, like breaking glass. A sound you might ignore once, hoping it was nothing more than a fallen bin or a stray cat knocking something over out in the street. But then, 10 or 15 minutes later, there was another noise. It sounded louder and heavier, something that seemed kind of like metallic in sound, a thud. That didn't just sit right. Derek thought it was strange, but with no shouting and no sounds of alarms and no more disturbances, he settled back and went back to sleep again. It was the sort of moment, I suppose, that like you register in the night, half asleep, half awake, and convince yourself in your sleepy kind of way that it's probably none of your business, that it's probably something of nothing. But by dawn, it was very much someone's business. Just before 6 a.m, at around 5:50, a passerby noticed something that just didn't look right. Smoke emanating from one of the bungalows. It was actually coming from number 46, which was Tilly Campbell's bungalow. Thick, dark smoke pushing out into the morning air. The alarm was raised immediately and a 999 call was placed. Fire crews were dispatched without delay. They arrived to find the house engulfed in smoke. The flames weren't now at this stage licking up through the roof, just black, churning smoke. It was a signal, I suppose, really, that whatever was happening inside had really taken hold. Firefighters fought their way in, methodical and focused, navigating the rooms as quickly as they could, checking for anyone that may be trapped inside. And that's when they found her. In an upstairs bedroom in her small, familiar little home where she should have been safe, they discovered the body of Tilly Campbell. She was positioned in a way that firefighters will never forget. She was slumped upright, with her back resting against the wall, her knees drawn in and her arms folded across them as if she'd curled inwards in fear or pain or even both. Her hair, though, was soaked in blood. There was no question. The trauma that she had suffered was evident from the moment they laid eyes on her. They did what they could to try and save Tilly. Carried her out from the house, tried to resuscitate her, but it was too late. Tilly was already gone. For those firefighters, it wasn't just another call out. This wasn't a distant tragedy or an anonymous blaze. It was a woman from their own community, a neighbour, a mother, a grandmother. And the brutal scene they'd walked into would stay with them for long after the flames were put out. This wasn't an accident. The fire wasn't the source of her death. It was the cover. Something, someone, had tried to hide what had really happened inside number 46. And that realisation would mark the beginning of a far darker investigation. One that would unearth not only a senseless murder, but the disturbing decisions behind it. As I said, although Tilly's home was on fire when emergency services arrived, it didn't take long to realise that the flames weren't the main concern. The injuries to her body didn't match what you'd expect from a victim of smoke inhalation or heat exposure. The firefighters who discovered her were experienced, and something about the scene didn't sit right. Despite the smoke and the chaos of a house fire, they could already tell it wasn't a tragic accident. This was something much worse. The group assistant commander at the scene, suspecting foul play, went back into the house once it was safe to do so. His job was to determine how the fire had started and if anything about it seemed unusual. What he found would reshape the course of the entire investigation. Inside the bungalow, he quickly identified not one, but two separate ignition points, both of which appeared to be deliberate. The first was upstairs, just outside the bedroom where Tilly's body had been found. A chair had been doused in flammable liquid and set alight beside a hot press. The flames from this had nearly consumed the whole cupboard, damaging much of the surrounding area. The second fire had been started on a mattress in an adjoining bedroom. Again, the pattern of burning suggested it hadn't been accidental. Someone had tried to ignite it intentionally. Obviously, setting multiple fires in separate locations inside a home is definitely a red flag for investigators. It suggests a conscious effort to destroy evidence, an attempt to obscure what really happened before help could arrive. It's a known tactic used by offenders in cases of violent assault or murder, often in the hope that the fire will either destroy forensic material or confuse the timeline of death. And that's exactly what investigators begin to suspect here. As the fire officer continued his assessment upstairs, other clues were coming into focus. A large kitchen knife was discovered lying on the bedroom floor. It wasn't hidden away or anything, but it was out in the open for anybody to find. The presence of the knife, alongside the condition of the body, was deeply alarming. The surrounding bedrooms had been disturbed also. Personal belongings had been scattered about. Cupboards and drawers had been yanked open, some of them emptied onto the floor. It was no longer just a suspected fire. It looked like someone had broken in, searched through the home and attempted to cover up their tracks with fire. Downstairs, the signs of forced entry were clear. One of the living room windows showed visible signs of having been pried open, likely the way the intruder had gained access. In the conservatory, another window pane had been completely shattered. That, I suppose, would explain the sharp metallic crash that Derek Lismore had reported hearing earlier that morning. At that stage, the fire crew made the decision to withdraw and preserve the scene. It was no longer their remit. This was now a crime scene, and it needed to be kept intact for police and forensic teams. The Police Service of Northern Ireland arrived and began their preliminary assessment. They took over the property, cordoned it off, and began the slow, methodical process of cataloguing evidence. From the moment they stepped inside, officers knew they were no longer simply responding to a fire. They were standing in the aftermath of a brutal targeted attack, one that had ended with the death of an elderly woman who had been defenceless in her own home. In the early stages of any criminal investigation, the priority is twofold: to protect the scene and to begin piecing together a timeline. What had happened inside number 46 Barna Park? And perhaps more urgently, who had been there and why? At this point, no one knew exactly how Tilly had died. That determination would come later from the State Pathologist of Northern Ireland. But what was obvious, even before the post-mortem, was that she had suffered catastrophic injuries that weren't related to the fire. Blood was found in large quantities at the scene, particularly in the upstairs bedrooms. And there were no signs that Tilly had attempted to escape the blaze. She hadn't been overcome by smoke while trying to flee. She'd been killed before the fire ever truly took hold. This fact shaped everything that followed. The presence of the knife, the ransacked rooms, the multiple points of ignition painted a picture of calculated violence. This wasn't a random burglary gone wrong. It was a targeted break-in that had escalated or perhaps always been intended to end in murder. The killer hadn't just taken her life, they tried to destroy the evidence too. As part of protocol, officers canvassed the neighbouring homes. Statements were taken from everyone in the area, including Derek Lismore, whose early testimony about the two distinct noises he'd heard on the night would later prove significant. Fire crews remained on the scene for several hours, helping to document the areas affected by the fire. Everything from burn patterns to broken glass were analysed for clues. Crime scene investigators photographed every room, fingerprinted surfaces, and began collecting potential trace evidence. It was a painstaking process, made harder by the smoke damage and the soot, but it was crucial. In addition to forensics, detectives also began looking at who might have had access to the house. Tilly had lived alone, but not in isolation. She had neighbours on either side of her, family who visited regularly, and carers who checked in from time to time. Was it someone she knew? Had she opened the door willingly? One thing investigators did know was that this hadn't been a spontaneous act of violence. The sequence of events, from the break-in to the scattered belongings to the deliberate arson, pointed to someone who had taken the time to plan, or at least to cover their tracks. This was not a situation where the fire had erupted due to a candle or a faulty appliance. This was deliberate destruction laid out with intent. And behind it all, somewhere out there, was the killer. Once the fire crews had confirmed there was no spread and no one else was in danger, they made their way door to door to check on the neighbours. Their final stop was at number 48 Barna Park, the semi-detached home next to Tilly Campbell's bungalow. Despite persistent knocking and even catching glimpses of movement behind the Venetian blinds, there was no reply. Concerned, one of the firefighters circled the property and at the rear spotted a man crouched inside, partially concealed behind the curtains, quietly smoking a cigarette. The posture was odd. After the firefighters warned they would involve police, the man finally opened the door. He introduced himself as Robert Harvey. Harvey, calm and composed, told the crew the house belonged to his mother, who was away on holiday. He claimed he had been asleep and had only just woken up. Firefighters found this hard to believe. With bright flashing lights and blaring sirens outside, I mean, that would be hard to ignore, even if you were in a deep sleep. Their unease deepened when they saw the washing machine in the kitchen still running. The display showed the cycle was just about to end. Now, I mean, very few people start a laundry load in the middle of the night, especially during an emergency next door. So when officers arrived, alerted to both the fire and the neighbour's peculiar reaction, they found a similar silence at Harvey's front door. Officers were prepared to force entry until at the last moment Harvey answered to them. He consented to them entering and officers immediately switched off the washing machine. A full load of wet clothes were ready in the drum, which officers removed to avoid destroying potential evidence or contaminating the scene. As they moved through the house, one item in particular caught their attention. A pair of trainers that were oddly nestled in the laundry pile. Meanwhile, Harvey walked into another room and picked up a paintbrush. And he sat there quietly on the bed and started painting. He just seemed detached from everything that was going on around him. On the bedroom floor were objects that added to the unease of the officers. Nearby lay a small axe, a hammer and a pair of scissors. When he was asked about them, Harvey stated simply that they were for personal protection. Within the hour, police had taken note of the mismatch between Harvey's behaviour and the severity of what had unfolded next door. The combination of a nearby violent crime scene, a fire clearly started deliberately, and unusual items on display were a real concern. Harvey was asked to remain at the scene as officers began cataloguing and seizing clothes, tools and all items found at the property to move forward with a formal investigation. When police finally informed Robert Harvey that Tilly Campbell had been found dead inside a smoke-filled home, his response was subdued, to say the least. There was a flicker of surprise, but that faded fairly quickly. He didn't ask for any details, he didn't seem shaken, and when officers pressed him further, he had very little to say at all. The circumstances surrounding him that morning already had officers on edge. His unusual behaviour during the fire response, his failure to answer the door, his attempts to avoid being seen, the oddly timed washing machine running at full cycle, and the presence of sharp tools near his bed had raised a number of red flags. Combined with what was beginning to emerge from the crime scene next door, it was enough to justify an arrest. So 36-year-old Robert Harvey was taken into custody on suspicion of murder. As officers brought him to the station, forensic teams began the task of collecting evidence. Harvey was processed and swabbed for DNA. They took samples from under his fingernails, collected strands of hair and bagged the clothes he had been wearing. At the same time, investigators combed through both his house and Tilly's house. In Harvey's washing machine, as I said, detectives found the load of freshly washed clothes. Among them also was the pair of trainers, standard, navy-coloured, heavily worn. These were bagged for forensic testing. Investigators also examined the rest of the property, paying particular attention to items that might connect him to the scene next door. His behaviour while under arrest remained calm and detached. Back at number 46 Berna Park, a second forensic team worked methodically through Tilly's home. Their aim was to map the attack, the movements of the perpetrator and anything that might tell them more about what had happened in those final moments. Meanwhile, Northern Ireland state pathologist Professor Jack Crane conducted a post-mortem examination on Tilly's body. The findings were deeply disturbing, to say the least. She had been subjected to a sustained and brutal assault. The report detailed multiple injuries to her head, face and neck. They weren't superficial wounds. Her skull had been fractured and her brain had suffered serious trauma. The blows were forceful and repeated, suggesting a heavy object had been used, likely a hammer or a similar tool. There were also defensive injuries on both of her arms, deep bruising, torn skin and two broken fingers. These were clear signs that Tilly had fought back, trying to shield herself from the attack. The poor woman. On her neck, the pathologist identified several significant bruises and abrasions. These marks were consistent with manual strangulation or an attempt to choke her during the struggle. Additional injuries were noted on her legs, indicating that she had also been struck there. Inside the bedroom where she'd been found, blood pattern analysis painted a grim picture. There were high-velocity spatter marks across the walls, an indicator of forceful impact. Much of the blood had been projected upwards from the bed, suggesting the blows to her head were delivered while she was either lying down or had fallen there during the struggle. It was a chaotic scene. A blood-streaked handprint was discovered on the wall near the light switch. One particularly crucial piece of evidence came in the form of the kitchen knife, found in Harvey's home. It matched the same style and brand as a set missing from Tilly's kitchen. Forensic testing later confirmed what detectives feared. Tilly's blood was on it. But the evidence didn't stop there. Traces of her blood were also discovered on the two trainers recovered from Harvey's washing pile. Lab analysis confirmed it was a positive match. The DNA wasn't just on the outside, it was embedded deep into the fabric, suggesting it had soaked in during the incident. And when technicians examined Harvey's fingernail scrapings, they detected trace genetic material that also matched Tilly Campbell. Further DNA evidence was found on his underwear, specifically inside the upper and lower portions of a pair of navy boxer shorts seized from his home. By now, investigators had begun to piece together a forensic narrative. A timeline was taking shape, supported by physical evidence linking Harvey not just to Tilly's house, but to her body and the assault she had endured. Everything, the shoes, the knife, the washing machine, even the location of the stains, was beginning to close in around him. Tilly's family, meanwhile, were still grappling with the loss. In a community like Dunahady, where violent crimes are rare, if ever, and neighbours often know each other by name, the discovery of such a brutal act left many in disbelief. For them, it wasn't just the loss of a loved one or a neighbour or a friend, it was the shocking manner in which she had died and the slow, painful unravelling of all the details. At this stage in the investigation, Harvey had not yet been formally charged, but the weight of forensic evidence was quickly mounting. And detectives were becoming more confident that the man that they had in custody wasn't just connected to the crime. He had been in the house, in that room, and had made every attempt to cover his tracks. What they didn't yet know was why. That part, like so many details in Tilly's case, would take time and more digging to fully understand. As investigators continued to build their case against Robert Harvey, more forensic links began to emerge, each one placing him closer to the scene of the crime. One of the most telling discoveries came when police examined the exterior of Tilly's bungalow. On the window frame of the rear lounge, they found fibres clinging to the surface. Fibres that forensic analysis later confirmed were consistent with the fabric of a sweatshirt belonging to Harvey. These fibres hadn't just drifted over by accident. They were the result of direct contact, strongly suggesting that Harvey had been in physical contact with the broken window during the course of the break-in. Glass fragments were also examined closely, tiny shards from Tilly's home recovered from the scene of the forced entry and from inside the bungalow itself were matched against samples collected from Harvey's clothing. These weren't superficial traces. The pieces found on his clothes were embedded in the fabric, consistent with someone climbing through a broken window or being in close proximity when the glass shattered. The most damning physical trail came from the conservatory. Amidst the debris and the soot-streaked floorboards, police had documented several bloody footprints. Crime scene investigators made cast impressions and later compared them to the footwear found in Harvey's washing pile. One of the trainers had a distinctive tread pattern, an unusual wear on the heel and the toe, and it matched perfectly with a print left in blood on the tiles inside Tilly's conservatory. The odds of it being coincidental were practically non-existent. At this point in the investigation, the physical evidence was piling up, but Harvey's own words, his shifting explanations and odd behaviour, only strengthened the case against him. When detectives brought him in for questioning, he initially played it cool. He claimed he had gone to bed early the previous night around 10:30 p.m. and had only woken up when the fire crew knocked on his door that morning. That would have been believable if not for what the digital trail had to say. Phone records obtained from Harvey's mobile provider showed activity well into the early hours of the morning. Specifically, a phone credit top-up at around 3:25 a.m., right in the middle of the window when the murder was believed to have taken place. It was a small action, but one that cast significant doubt on his timeline. When presented with this information, Harvey appeared momentarily flustered. He eventually claimed that he must have rolled over in his sleep and somehow managed to activate his phone, top up his credit and enter the correct code by accident. Even the detectives conducting the interview seemed taken aback by the absurdity of his explanation. One reportedly asked him, "Are you telling me you accidentally rolled over, dialed 4444 and somehow entered the top up code for your phone?" Harvey had no answer. It was plainly a lie, or at best, a desperate attempt to wriggle out of an increasingly tight corner. After that exchange, Harvey grew noticeably less cooperative. He stopped offering answers, avoided eye contact, and began refusing to speak altogether. From that moment on, his interviews became one-sided. Detectives asked questions and Harvey said nothing. Still, the investigation continued. Detectives continued to comb through the evidence piece by piece, and one final discovery would prove pivotal. As part of a wider canvas of the neighbourhood, officers began checking bins and outer containers for anything suspicious. At number 39 Berna Park, just a few doors down from Harvey, they found a bloody sock stuffed into a household recycling bin. The residents were absolutely adamant they had no idea how it got there, and insisted it didn't belong to anyone in their household. The sock was removed and sent for urgent forensic analysis. Lab results confirmed the blood saturating the fabric belonged to Tilly. Investigators now had what amounted to a discarded piece of evidence intimately connected to the crime, left just a few feet from Harvey's property. The positioning of it suggested an attempt to dispose of something incriminating, but not far enough away to be convincing. It looked rushed, careless even. When Harvey was called in for another interview and shown the sock, his demeanour changed. Previously, he'd been somewhat flat in his tone, unemotional and, as I said, detached. But the moment detectives presented him with the sock and the forensic findings that came with it, he became visibly guarded. He didn't try to talk his way out of it this time. When asked if it was his, he simply said, "I don't know." The sock was soaked, as I said, in Tilly's blood. The implication was clear. Harvey had been wearing it, or at least handling it, during or after the attack. After that meeting, Harvey declined to participate in any more interviews. He gave no further statements and requested legal representation. It was the last time he would directly engage with the investigation. But by then, police already had what they needed. The fibre matches, the bloodied trainers, the sock, the DNA, the footprints, the broken glass, the suspicious timing of the washing machine, and a timeline that collapsed his alibi completely. So, on October the 13th, 2006, just 5 days after the murder, 36-year-old Robert Harvey was formally charged with the murder of Matilda Tilly Campbell. The news hit Donaghadhy hard. People in the town had been reeling since the morning of the fire. Now they were confronted with the unthinkable truth that the man accused of killing a vulnerable elderly neighbour had been living just next door. Neighbours who had once nodded politely as they passed him were suddenly wondering how they hadn't seen any warning signs. The idea that someone could commit such an act and then sit calmly painting at his easel while a fire burned and a woman lay dead next door left many people speechless. Harvey's arrest didn't bring relief. It brought more questions. What had pushed him to do it? Why Tilly? Was it random? Was it personal? And most of all, how long had he been capable of this? Those answers would only begin to emerge as the case moved towards trial. In what would be his final interview with detectives after his arrest, Robert Harvey was presented with the full scope of the evidence gathered against him. Though he said nothing in response, the impact was visible. He slumped forward in his chair, seemingly crushed by the gravity of what had been laid out. Harvey was formally charged with her murder. He was held on remand as legal proceedings got underway. But the case would move slowly. Harvey's legal team was replaced partway through the process, further delaying matters. In the end, it would take nearly 3 years to reach a conclusion. Finally, in September 2009, Harvey pleaded guilty. On the 22nd of that month, he was convicted and sentenced to a minimum of 23 years behind bars. During the sentencing hearing, the court was told that Harvey had been intoxicated at the time of the attack. He had broken into Tilly's home while under the influence and launched what was described as a savage and prolonged assault. The presiding judge called it a crime of extreme violence, saying Harvey had shown Tilly no mercy whatsoever. Further details revealed a troubling pattern of criminality in Harvey's past. Court records confirmed that he had an accumulated 32 previous convictions for burglary, in addition to offences involving criminal damage and threats of violence. When police had searched his house following his arrest, they uncovered items consistent with that record. Balaclavas, stolen jewellery and other evidence that supported his history of illegal activity. Police body cam footage captured some of these items as they were seized. Though Harvey never gave a full account of what had happened on the night of the murder, police were able to piece together much of the sequence from witness statements and forensic evidence. On the evening of the 9th of October 2006, Harvey had been drinking heavily in the local pub. Multiple people who were there that night recalled him making disturbing comments, including one instance where he reportedly said he'd kill for money. After leaving the pub, Harvey kept drinking and ended up spending his last few pounds on a poker machine. With no money left and likely feeling desperate and agitated, he returned to Barna Park in the early hours of the following morning. Detectives believe that when he made the decision to break into the home next door, belonging to Tilly, the assumption was that she might have some money or valuables inside. When Tilly, 77 and largely housebound, interrupted the break-in, Harvey reacted violently. In what investigators described as a frenzied outburst, he dragged her into the spare bedroom. That's where her body would later be found. To try and hide what he'd done, Harvey then attempted to set the house on fire. This was a brutal crime, but more than that, it was deeply personal in its violation. Tilly had lived quietly in her home, just metres away from the man who would ultimately take her life. A woman of limited mobility, known in her community, attacked in the place where she should have been safest. The evidence against Harvey was overwhelming, and his guilty plea, though long delayed, brought some degree of closure. But it could never undo the loss, nor the fear that settled in the wake of that night. After Harvey was sentenced, police delivered a statement on behalf of Tilly's children. It read, "The past 3 years have been very long and painful for us as a family. Mum was a frail, vulnerable lady who lived on her own in a home where she had felt safe. She suffered a horrible death by this evil man, and no court sentence will ever be enough for him. We have lost a mother, and our children have lost their grandmother. As a family, we feel that society needs to be protected against monsters like Robert Harvey. No other family should have to endure what we have gone through. Tilly Campbell should have felt safe in her own home. She was a mother, a grandmother, and a widow who'd spent most of her life in Dunahady. She was known locally, liked by her neighbours, and although her health had started to limit her, she still valued her independence. What happened to her was cruel, senseless, and deeply unfair. This wasn't just the loss of one woman. It left a whole family grieving. Her children and her grandchildren have to live with what she went through and what was taken from them. Her neighbours too were left shaken. The idea that someone living just a few feet away could be capable of such violence isn't easy to come to terms with. And that's the thing, you never really know what's happening behind someone else's front door. People talk about trusting your instincts, but most of us would never expect something like this to happen right next door to us. There's no real justice when a life is taken in this way. No sentence or verdict can undo it. But what we can do is remember Tilly for who she was, a strong, proud woman who should have had more time with her family. She deserved peace. She deserved safety. What happened to her was cruel and senseless, as I said, and it robbed her of the dignity every person is entitled to in their final years. She was loved, she was known, and she mattered. And above all else, she should have been safe in her own home.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.